Big Swinging Stocks acknowledges the traditional custodians of Australia's lands, skies and waterways and pays respects to elders past, present and emerging. Welcome back to another episode of Big Swinging Stocks. This week, we've got Brownlow medalist, captain of the West Eagles, Chris Judd. He's won every conceivable elite sport medal during his 14-year footy career and now has taken his ability to hit new heights by trying to beat market returns. Here to talk how he invests and how he's taking the investment world by storm. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Chris. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm so excited to chat about how you've ended up with now an investment fund, but I want to bring you all the way back. What's your first investing memory? Like, is this a long-term passion?
My first investing memory was I made the under 16 AOS team and we got given $2,500 for that. And the old man said, what are you going to do with that? And I said, I was going to invest it. And so we walked down to the news agency. We bought a share magazine, you know, one of those magazines with ideas, the worst ideas you can generally follow. And we bought AWA, I reckon, which was a small electrical manufacturer. And just through good luck rather than good work, it went up and we made some money. And that was the start of an investing passion. I sort of bought my own stocks and managed my own investing throughout my footy career. I was quite passionate about that, but didn't really know what I was doing. I was executing through brokers. I was buying sort of large mid-cap or really large-cap blue-chip companies, which I find really hard to have an edge in as a retail investor. And when I was about 28, met a guy who was from West Australia, who was chairman of a major stockbroking firm over there. And through that process, really learned how to trade micro-caps and really learn how to sell. I think, you know, shares are an asset class. The skill is in the selling. You know, in property, if you buy property well, you don't really need to sell it. Maybe some of the new taxation laws in Victoria will change that. But by and large, you haven't had to sell it. But stocks, particularly micro-cap stocks, you know, the buying can feel relatively easy, but the selling is what you get paid for.
Yeah, the magic. But you're 16, you sign with AIS, you get a significant paycheck. And with inflation, I mean, that would have been a huge sum of money.
It's a pretty good check, isn't it?
It's a pretty good check. Tell me, how did you know to invest? I thought you were going to say, I want to do something fun with it, but that's pretty sophisticated for 16. What was your exposure to investing before that?
My parents aren't interested in money, either of them, and not sophisticated investors or anything. My grandfather was on my dad's side. He loved his stocks and, you know, wouldn't be classed as a big investor, but certainly a passionate investor. And he was an accountant by trade. So he was an early investor in News Corp, I believe, and got some of those floats like CBA when they went public, and Telstra, which didn't turn out to be as good as some of the other ones. But yeah, it seems like it skipped a generation. So my old man didn't get the bug, but I did. And it was probably the modelling provided from that grandfather that led to it.
So big part of your early life, clearly something that you then took with you to your career in the AFL. I just want you to tell me whether there was a pressure while you were like the most famous AFL player in your time. I'm certain you were earning far above average. Was there you said that you invested that money that you were earning throughout your career, which is phenomenally responsible. Do you feel there was a pressure to kind of, I don't know, live large, spend big, buy a Lamborghini? I don't know if you did, but you may have bought a Lamborghini.
No, maybe going bald at 19 precluded that sort of party boy lifestyle. Maybe it made more sense to become old and boring sooner rather than later. But no, look, I think one of the things it served was really trying to grow some interest outside of sport. So I, you know, there's a lot more pressure in professional sport than people who haven't played it would realise. When I look back at how much stress I felt under in that time, I shake my head. It just seems completely ridiculous. But certainly in Western Australia, you know, I went there at 18, and West Coast in that state is a wonderful footy club, but just there's a huge amount of attention on them from the press. And that always made me uncomfortable. So I just had this view, if you would read a story that was positive and you felt good about it, you're really vulnerable handing over control of your emotions to the press on when negative stories came. So I was just really clear to avoid all media. So you'd say it was a control strategy. A more enlightened strategy would be able to read it and not be affected by it. But my strategy then was just a control strategy, just to avoid all media. So I just read the Fin Review every day because there wasn't going to be any West Coast stories in it. Didn't even have free-to-air TV, had Foxtel for most of the time, so I didn't have any news exposure at all whilst I was over there. And that was sort of how it really grew. I remember reading the Fin Review as an 18-year-old, and when I start reading it, there are a lot of terms that I wouldn't understand, and then 12 months later there were fewer terms I didn't understand, and then, you know, 6 years later it maybe didn't feel as interesting or sophisticated enough for the level of knowledge I'd acquired. So that was a long sort of process that was largely driven by really just wanting to learn some stuff. You know, footy's a great profession, but you do find, you know, I sort of found after the age of 21, there just wasn't really much learning in there. You sort of learned the footy lessons. There's still some psychology, group dynamic lessons you pick up, but yeah, mentally you can sort of feel your brain start to atrophy a bit if you don't look for other interests.
It's basically, I mean, you were diversifying not only your income stream by focusing on investing, but also just your personal skills by creating this completely untethered passive income for yourself. I think that's remarkable for such a young person. Is that your investing why, having passive income? Is that what you were drawn to?
No, and I mean, most of the stuff I invest in isn't passive at all. So it's not that. It's probably building resilience in a broader sense. I never liked the idea of relying on other people for important parts of your life. So when you're an AFL club and, you know, you've got a property steward that will take your – West Coast, the property steward would take your boots, your shorts, your socks and your jumper to the game. And that always just made me feel uncomfortable. So he would take my jumper, but all the other stuff I would make sure I packed myself, because I didn't want to be relying on if the property steward had a bad day, I didn't want him not having my shorts. And I think that sort of example flows through to most of my life. You know, I was aware, you know, when you're a footy player, you're sort of the duck on the creek at a tourist destination, and people come and they throw you bread, but eventually people stop coming to that tourist destination, and that's when you retire from professional sport. So the idea of just having intermediaries manage all my financial accounts just left me feeling uncomfortable. So it probably cost me initially, like I was in WA in one of the great mining booms of all time, and I was investing with Melbourne Brokers. It's a good broker, but I missed all that iron ore stuff, a lot of the small cap stuff. You know, I was buying ANZ and Tabcorp and these sorts of stocks. So it cost me on the short term, but the longer term game is, you know, you can now understand markets and have the opportunity to do something once football's finished.
Yeah. So fiercely independent. So I can see now why, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, why you now have started your own investment fund, like this real desire to get hands-on with your investments. Tell me, what's the portfolio now? You said you used to invest in large caps. You're really now into sort of the small, mid and micro caps and being quite active in your trading. Is there anything else in your portfolio?
Well, I've misled you a bit there. How we invest now, we call ourselves macro investors. We start with top-down views on macro thematics we like. We don't really see as much IP in those macro thematics. They're things that, you know, I haven't heard a fund manager not like copper in the last 5 years. You know, we like the EV metals. We think the underinvestment in oil is really significant. Mm. We think aging demographics is a nice thematic to play. We like uranium. We think central banks are going to have to choose between saving their bond market or saving their currency, and the, you know, one of the winners of that would be gold. So those sort of things are really common. Where we maybe differentiate to some Aussie funds, you know, you hear Aussie funds talk a lot about it's not timing the market, it's time in the market, and that's really not how we invest. So you think a lot of funds, if they're playing 2020 cricket and they're chasing down 160 runs, they'd try and get 8 runs and over. We're trying, when we see a really good bowler down the other end and the field's out, we're trying to survive and push singles. When we see a crap bowler down the other end and the field's up, we're trying to swing for the hills and get 15 and over. So right now, and that bowler to us is global liquidity. So right now you see negative M2 growth in the US. Global liquidity is really tight, let alone the credit crunch you're seeing in the US banking system. So where there's not much liquidity around, we want to be in liquid positions. So right now we are positioned a lot of our stocks in larger cap positions because there is just no liquidity in small caps. Even the small caps we do have, where there's no liquidity around, we have a bias to companies that are producing a lot of free cash flow relative to their market cap today, because when there's no liquidity, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow, as opposed to, you know, 18 months post-COVID, where there was truckloads of liquidity. It was all about the promises of a dollar tomorrow was worth more than a dollar today because there was so much liquidity sloshing around. So that embracing convexity, if you like, or scaling up and scaling down risk is really important to how we look to invest. And then, of course, we've got just the generalized bottom-up analysis on how we select. So right now, yeah, our positions are, a lot of them are large cap, and the micro caps are producing a lot of free cash flow today. Our bias in where we would love to invest is in under-researched micro caps, but right now there's just not enough liquidity for us to do that. But in an ideal world, that's where we'd be fishing.
Yeah, okay. So cyclical, but like there is quite a big difference in the way you invest and what you're invested in as
big time. Different. And a really broad mandate, because we don't want to just be like, I see funds who frame themselves as your value partner or your growth partner. And that's fine when conditions are a certain, you know, when you've got interest rates at zero around the world, great to be a growth investor, but you just pop committed to a certain strategy and those rules, which are artificial, if you like, just turn into a jail. So we want to be flexible and be able to make money in different environments.
Markets. Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think I've ever heard someone talk about their fund in that way. It's definitely been that traditional, we're either here to make, I don't know, I guess I call it the Michael Francis approach. Like we're here to make
lots of money. That's right, we're your growth partner.
Or we're here to be like a defensive, almost boomer, long-term. So it's interesting to see that you've, I suppose, the niche here, the differentiation for your fund and your approach is taking maybe the best of both worlds, would you say?
It is. And like, you know, personally, I'm fully allocated in this strategy. So I haven't got an ability to diversify elsewhere. So this needs to be able to work in different environments. And we clearly want to, there's no use us starting something that already exists.
Yeah, of course, you've got to find a niche in Well, a good time perhaps to prove the strategy, given we've had a huge change in the market. Personal question from me that I didn't put to you is, do you think that we're in for a bear market, or are you backing some of the punters who think we might be trading vertical for a number of years? What do you think?
So I think it depends on your time frame, clearly, like all these things. But I think that debt ceiling in the US is a significant event that we need to get through. And I think that's going to suck up a lot of liquidity. So, yeah, I think in the short term, call it 3 or 4 months, when you couple that with the amount of money leaving deposit base in banks moving to money market funds, we think the market's going to be pretty soft for call it 3 or 4 months. One of their North Stars, if you like, is that 37% of US treasuries need to be refinanced in less than a year. Right? The US government's currently paying 2% on those treasuries. If they pay 5% on those treasuries at a time when tax receipts are rolling off, like they are in the US, I think the US can roll into a sort of a balance of payments crisis. And we think that's underappreciated. So everyone will talk about the Fed's mandate being inflation and full employment. We think their third mandate, which isn't spoken about and I guess is unofficial in a sense, is to keep the US government funded.
Yeah.
And if push comes to shove and they've got to fund those rates closer to 2% while inflation is still above their target range, we think the Fed will choose to fund the government at rates the government can afford. So that's sort of the bond market is telling you rates are coming down towards the end of the year. We think they will. We don't think inflation will be back down to 2% by the time that happens. And so we think you've got a structurally higher inflation environment for a period of time. And in reality, when government debt to GDP is as high as it is, you actually need the inflation. You know, deflation's a much scarier phenomenon than inflation when you've got government debt to GDP over 120% like it is in the US. So, yeah, we think market's going to be soft. We think once that liquidity changes, we think markets will pop. And we also are conscious of the fact that people are positioned for a crash. People always think back to the last war. You know, professional investors now, they've generally invested through COVID, which was a real event, and a bump back up, and the GFC. which was a real event and didn't bump back up nearly as rapidly as COVID. But we're conscious to not be waiting for a crash either. We think there might be some softness. We'd like to get through the debt ceiling until the Treasury General account gets filled up. Mm-hmm. And so we'll start the fund with about 30% cash, which is more cash than we'd like, but recognising the fact that, you know, markets are pretty tough for the time being.
Yeah. So you've mentioned you're personally invested in this fund. I want to know, you've had a career, you're now having a brand new career that you've clearly been interested in for a while. Would you share with us what your net worth is?
No, I wouldn't.
Well, in that case then, can you tell me what's been the single maybe asset class or single portfolio item, stock baby, that has attributed to the biggest increase in your net worth thus far?
I had a great run on Cobalt in 2017.
Oh, my God, you were there before the news was then, clearly.
Yeah, so it was sort of lead up to that. You know, that was a typical sort of page 17 story that became a page one story.
Yeah.
By the end of 17, every second person on Twitter was an expert in the supply chain issues with Congolese copper. And I was there with them. So, look, that was great. I had a good uranium run in 07 to 10 at a company Extract, which went from a tiny gold company in Meekatharra to, you know, a $2 billion uranium company. In Namibia.
You didn't miss WA resources boom then, did you?
I finally got the joke. But yeah, I mean, they're the wins. There's plenty of losses along the way, plenty of things that went to the moon and I didn't sell, plenty of lessons learned. So
let's talk about that, because I loved that quote, knowing when to sell is more important than knowing when to buy, and it's not just about time in the market. So tell me a little bit about your thesis on selling, and when do you know it's the right time?
Look, it's a bit of an art more than a science, selling, but I think you want to be clear if you're invested in one of the next great companies in the world, like an Apple or an Amazon or a Google, and most of the companies I'm in aren't going to be that. They're going to mean revert if they're commodity companies. Yeah, you get the odd one like Fortescue that hasn't, but that's a bit of a freak. But generally the things I'm in are going to mean revert at some stage. So if you've had a run on it, you need to be thinking about whether or not to sell it. We're not collectors of stocks. They're there to be sold. And I guess it's for us, it's looking out 6, 12, 18 months and what are the potential things that could get that stock to re-rate again. If it's had a run or we can't clearly articulate why that individual stock could re-rate or the broader sector could re-rate in the next 6 months to 18 months, then it's really time for us to sell and move on to the next adventure.
And I have to ask you, because you've had a career, there's a long-term interest for you. If you were starting at 20 with the cash flow that you might have had at 20, would you invest any differently? How would you play it?
No, I mean, this is not investment advice. I think young people need to take on significant risk. Because they've got their whole working life ahead of them if it doesn't work out. And if it does work out, they've had a step change in their wealth. And if you look back to, say, our parents' generation, they got to do that through residential property. Now, residential property doesn't seem all that risky, but when you leverage it up 10x sometimes or 5x, depending on how big a deposit you've got to put down, slapping that much leverage on something is really high-risk transaction. And they got to do that at a time when wages to property prices were way lower than what they are now. Our generation, they could buy property, but it's bloody expensive, and particularly
we can't
in Australia.
Use the investment advice of our parents. Like the investment proof that was their returns on property, I don't see how that can be replicated again.
No, and societally, in it from a societal point of view, if it is, you think there's going to be some real problems around inequality. But what I think you can take from that is the benefits of taking on a significant amount of risk when you're young. Because said investment, whilst it seems safe, levered up like that, is risky.
Yeah, Kate Howard had a fantastic sort of equation on that you've drawn on. Just used to be a portfolio manager at Fidelity, and she's like, young people don't treat their future earnings as an investment. They don't consider how long they have and how much money they can make, and that as like a cash flow equation of how much risk you can take on. I think it's a really great point you make around you've got the time. and you've got
difference between risk and stupidity as well. You know, like that's
there's an art to that as well. To quote you back to yourself,
it doesn't mean you just go out and buy monkey pictures, but
yeah,
try and find where you think you could have an edge and take on some risk.
So monkey pictures, not an NFT fan then, Chris, I assume.
No, I think it's interesting. Like, I think that whole world is interesting. Yeah, I think digital scarcity was a really interesting invention. And you know, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but you think of all the digital abundance we're going to have with AI.
Yeah.
And in 3 years' time, you're going to be speaking to someone on Twitter, and it's going to be very hard to decipher if that's a person or an AI-generated bot. To balance that out with some digital scarcity where you can prove that person's transacted historically like a person, there's going to have to be some safeguard in place to stop, even just from a cost perspective. Otherwise, you'll have these organisations creating, you know, 10 billion bots on Twitter. And
that's a really good point.
That digital conversation is going to become unusable. So whether blockchain has a role in that, who knows? I think it's interesting. I think it was an interesting invention, certainly Bitcoin and I guess the extension of NFTs, but not something the fund will be investing in.
So you've talked about the investment philosophy of the fund. Tell us a little bit more about the fund. Is this for retail investors? Are you
just for wholesale investors?
Wholesale investors.
And we're long only global equities. We'd like to express our views just on Australian equities, and most of the positions will be. But there's certain things that are just hard to play in Australia. If you want large cap copper exposure, you're really just down to Sandfire, which has been a great company, but just looks really expensive compared to some of its peers that are listed in Canada. So we can't express the view that we want to here. We'll go overseas, but our first preference is to express it through SEX-listed equities.
Mm. And from talked about your views, but have you got some like books or podcasts that have also really contributed to the way you think about investing today?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, most of my week is spent reading commentary from different macroeconomic strategists around the world. You know, Luke Groman, I love. Kirill Sokoloff, I love. Eric Basmajian, Danielle DiMartino-Booth. The list goes on. There's sort of that's the job. You know, that's what I spend all day doing is consuming content. I've got a young guy with me, Tom, who's an analyst. So if we're not reading it, we're sort of dribbling crap at one another about it. That's how we spend our day. So, yeah, there's a whole host. Yeah, the list could go on forever.
So what about if people want to get in touch with your content? Where can they find you?
So they can find me at Chris Judd Invest on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Talk Your Book is a show I've been doing for probably 4 years now perhaps, where I sit down with a different fund manager and they express what their highest conviction investment idea is. So they can find that on YouTube or on Ticker News on their various platforms there.
I really liked it. I think if anyone wants sort of, it's highly sophisticated, like technical analysis, but I watched a couple of episodes and
thank you, Alex.
I was like, yeah,
you were the one.
Great.
You were the one who was watching. I wasn't sure.
It was me. So highly recommend everyone checks it out. I think I want to ask you one final question, a complete stab in the dark. If you were writing the headline for January 1st, 2024 of the AFR, what do you think the headline will read? Or what would you like it to read, considering some of your convictions?
Sarah off a blistering start. How smart's Chris?
Returns up 300x. We love it.
I don't know. I mean, I think the US, I'm not one of those guys that are desperate to try and call a recession. I think the US is probably in a recession currently. I think they'll be coming out of it by then. We're probably a little bit behind where they're at. You know, we'll probably get job losses by then. I would have thought I don't think we'll be stimulating Australia by then. I think we will be in the US, but we won't be too far behind. New Zealand look like they've paused already. So
yeah,
I think we'll be probably doom scrolling by then. That doesn't mean that asset prices will be going down because assets prices aren't the economy. But yeah, I think the economy will be feeling a little bit challenged. And then hopefully the middle of next year, it starts to turn around.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great. We'll check back in with you on January 1st.
Check back
1st
in, yeah. Only if it's true.
Absolutely.
Just edit that bit out.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Big Swinging Stocks. It's been a real privilege chatting to you, and best wishes with the fund. I'm sure we'll cross paths again, but thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Alex. It was good fun.
And to all our listeners, you can catch Chris at Chris Judd Invests or Talk Your Book, like he said, on YouTube. But make sure to like and subscribe to the pod if you want to see more of us. And I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
This podcast is brought to you by SelfWealth and operates under AFSL number 421789 as general advice only. Because we can't take into account your personal objectives or financial situation, you should seek independent professional financial advice before making any investment decision. For more information and our financial disclosure statement, check the show notes.